to Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our special guest this week, Jeffrey Stone, has written that the United States has never attempted to punish opposition to government policies, except in times of war. Nevertheless, he continues, the United States has a long and unfortunate history of overreacting to the dangers of wartime. Stone is the author of Perilous Times, Free Speech in Wartime, from the Sedition Act of 1798 to the War on Terrorism. And he will discuss his book with Talking History's Fred Nielsen. After that, Lawrence Whitner will talk about free speech in America in the form of peace activism and answer the question, has peace activism ever stopped a war? And Fiona Beatty will tell us about a museum where you can learn more about the concept of freedom. But first, as we do each week, let's look at some related items of historical interest in the news that you may have missed. Whenever we talk about freedom in America, Brown versus the Board of Education enters the conversation, especially with its 50th anniversary celebration in 2004. Occasionally mentioned, although it too had its 50th anniversary in 2004, is the case of Korematsu versus the United States. As we often do on Talking History and in response to various requests, we've decided to call to your attention a wonderful and relatively new resource in Korematsu, which, in case you've blanked on it, was the major case brought by Japanese Americans to contest their confinement in so-called relocation centers during World War II. In December 2004, a conference was convened in Los Angeles at which several notable authorities on Japanese internment spoke. Their papers were later collected in the spring 2005 issue of Law and Contemporary Problems. Two of the several papers are worth noting in particular, as their scholarly contributions are built on direct personal experience. The first is by Judge A. Wallace Tashima, who along with his family was forced from his home into the Poston Relocation Center in Arizona in 1942. He's now a senior judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. The other is by Eugene Gressman, now an emeritus professor at the University of North Carolina School of Law. Gressman was the law clerk to Associate Justice Frank Murphy in 1944 when the U.S. Supreme Court decided Korematsu. Once again, these and other very informative articles on Japanese internment can be found in the spring 2005 issue of Law and Contemporary Problems. When we return, Fred Nielsen talks with Jeffrey Stone about free speech in wartime, and Lawrence Whitner takes a look at the history of anti-war activity in the United States and its impact on war. This is Talking History. If the nation is at war and its security hangs in the balance, should free speech be protected? Has free speech ever been compromised in the United States during times of war? And if so, what resulted? These are particularly timely questions, and Talking History's Fred Nielsen asks them of his guest this week, Jeffrey Stone.
The United States government has never attempted to punish opposition to government policies except in time of war. According to my guest, Jeffrey Stone, the U.S. has a long and unfortunate history of overreacting to the dangers of wartime, repeatedly going too far in restricting civil liberties. And in virtually every instance, the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798, the assaults on free speech during World War I, the relocation of Japanese Americans during World War II, the Red Scare of the 1950s, the nation has come to regret its actions. Here to discuss that long history, Jeffrey Stone is a professor of history at the University of Chicago Law School and the author of Perilous Times, Free Speech in Wartime, from the Sedition Act of 1798 to the War on Terrorism. Professor Stone, welcome.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Let's begin with what is, I suppose, the most basic question. If a nation is at war, its security at risk, why should free speech be protected?
Well, there's really two elements to that question. One is to what extent it's appropriate in time of war to restrict civil liberties in general and free speech in particular. And the answer to that is that there's nothing inviolable about civil liberties or about free speech. And if the circumstances truly warrant it, some restrictions on our liberties is appropriate. So the question from that perspective is simply one of degree. But free speech is really different from most other liberties in the sense that it is essential to the way in which we as a society make our decisions. And when we interfere with individuals' ability to engage in criticism and dissent, what we do is to undermine the very process by which we believe that we as a society make wise decisions. So not only is there a concern when we restrict free speech about limiting the personal freedoms of individuals, but it also can be thought to be especially dangerous in a democratic society because it cuts off public debate, which means that it makes it more difficult for us to actually make wise decisions.
I suppose left to our own devices, we'd all prefer to have people agree with us than disagree. We like our ideas validated. And I suppose that's even more true in time of war than in time of peace. You make an interesting observation at one point in your book that the First Amendment cuts against human nature. It demands that we be better than we are probably going to be if left to our own devices.
Right. It's not part of human nature to be tolerant of those with whom we disagree. There is a very strong instinct to coerce agreement or compliance if necessary. Most people, as you say, do not like to be criticized, and most people who believe they are right don't much want to have other people going around saying they are wrong. And therefore, as we look at human history and governments throughout all of world history, there is a very strong and inevitable temptation to want to suppress, if not to behead, people who criticize us. And this is true even in private relationships as well as in public. And so what the First Amendment does demand of a democratic society is that it promote and nurture a kind of tolerance and respect for opposing views and ideally a willingness to listen as well as to tolerate opposing views on the theory that we may not be right, that the other person might have all or part of the truth, and that keeping an open mind is essential to making right decisions. So it is a sense of self-discipline that people need to learn. When we talk about creating a democracy in Iraq, for example, as we've already seen, it means not just giving them voting booths. It means transforming the culture in a way that enables them to live with the demands that democracy makes upon individuals. And those demands are often very great.
America faces its first challenge very quickly in the early days of the Republic in the 1790s. John Adams is president. The Federalists are in power. There is tension with France abroad. And in that climate, Adams and the Federalists pass the Sedition Act of 1798, which you describe as perhaps the most grievous assault on free speech in the history of the United States. What did that law do?
Well, in practical effect, the law made it a crime for any person to criticize the president, the Congress, or the government of the United States with the intent of bringing them into contempt or disrepute. And that law was applied and interpreted by the Federalists, who controlled all of the branches of the national government at that time, as a way of repressing any of their critics, particularly those of the then Republican Party, the party of Jefferson and Madison. And the goal of the act, although it was justified as a war measure, the underlying goal was essentially aimed at the 1800 presidential election. John Adams had defeated Jefferson by only 3 electoral votes in 1796. The Federalists were very anxious about the possibility that the Republicans might win the presidency in 1800, and the Sedition Act of 1798 was enacted in part as a tool to prevent Republican critics and Republican editors from criticizing the Adams administration or the Federalists. And it was used only against members of Jefferson's party and essentially only against critics and editors of Republican newspapers. In the end, this was one of the good instances in which the American public was actually turned off by the effort to suppress their debate, and they voted the Federalists out of office and, in fact, elected Jefferson in the election of 1800. But it was a very severe act designed clearly to prevent political opposition to the party in power.
The circumstances for the passage of that act involve a war that never actually happened, a kind of quasi-war with France. Circumstances are very, very different 70 years later. It's the American Civil War. Abraham Lincoln is president. The security of the nation, the survival of the nation, very much hangs in the balance. How did Lincoln, under those very different circumstances, deal with the issue of free speech and civil liberties?
Lincoln had a very mixed record on the question of free speech. On the one hand, Lincoln did not enact a sedition act and did not have a formal policy during the Civil War of suppressing the many newspapers and citizens who were extremely critical of Lincoln. One of the things that we often forget about the Civil War and about Lincoln is that during much of the war, he was extremely unpopular in the North. Many people simply believed that the right course for the nation was to let the South go. As the casualty lists grew enormously, 600,000 Americans died in the Civil War, and the Lincoln administration imposed the nation's first conscription act. This caused a great deal of protest and opposition. And of course, the Emancipation Proclamation was at the time highly controversial, and many Northerners hated the thought that they were going south to fight to free slaves who would then come north and take their jobs while they were out dying on the battlefields. So Lincoln was excoriated in a way that no president in American history has ever been attacked. And it is to his great credit that he did not pursue the enactment of a sedition act and that he did not have a formal policy designed to repress that opposition. Part of the reason for that was because of the political realities of the time. Much of the opposition to Lincoln came from border states, and Lincoln was determined to keep those border states within the Union, and an effort to suppress criticism would have backfired. And part of it also was that Lincoln genuinely did have a fairly sophisticated understanding of the need for free speech in a democratic society. Nonetheless, he gave a great deal of freedom to his generals, and his generals were often quite repressive. More than 300 newspapers were shut down at one point or another during the Civil War by the Union armies. And we're talking here not about in the South, but in states like Ohio and Pennsylvania and New York. And Lincoln's general view on these matters was to be dismayed by these actions, but never to take really definitive steps to prevent it from happening in the future.
One of the interesting things about Lincoln, too, is that he has a personal history with criticism of his government. He begins his public career, he's only, what, 2 weeks or so in the House of Representatives, by excoriating James K. Polk for the Mexican War.
Yes, so Lincoln is a very intemperate young congressman, enters the United States Congress during the Mexican War. He, as you said, excoriated President Polk in quite extreme terms. And when he went back to Illinois for re-election, he was rejected for re-election in large part because people accused him of essentially being disloyal and treasonous and not supporting the troops. So Lincoln had this sort of poignant personal experience, which I'm sure informed his own attitude towards criticism of the government and criticism of himself when 12 years later he wound up being president of the United States.
Which leads me to wonder what difference the personality, the temperament, the personal history of a president makes. Lincoln has this experience with criticizing a president that you've described, and he shows remarkable restraint during the Civil War. Woodrow Wilson during World War I seems to be cut from different cloth. There we see his government aggressively passing laws and going after people who dissent.
Yes, Lincoln was in many ways a much more tolerant person by nature than Wilson. Wilson was someone who did not brook criticism and did not like being called to account even before he became president. But when he became president, this became a really salient characteristic of his administration. He faced a serious difficulty, and that is, unlike World War II, where the United States had been attacked at Pearl Harbor, there was no moment in which the United States was attacked leading to our entry of World War I. Indeed, it's important to remember that Wilson was reelected in 1916 on the platform that he had kept us out of war. Nonetheless, a year later, he decided that it was necessary for the U.S. to enter the war. But the problem he faced was that the American people were sharply divided from the very beginning on whether this was a war that we should be fighting. And as a consequence, Wilson really needed to do two things in order to generate the kind of enthusiasm within the nation that would cause people to make the sacrifices that war demands. On the one hand, he needed to promote the cause of the war, and to that end, he created the Committee for Public Information, which was literally a propaganda arm of the White House, led by a man named Creel, the function of which was to produce a flood of pamphlets, newspapers, lectures, editorials, even movies, designed to generate a hatred of all things German and a suspicion of hatred of anyone who might be thought to be disloyal or not to be fully committed in supporting the war. And on the other side, because there was a great deal of criticism of the war, Wilson needed to suppress that. And so he got through Congress first the Espionage Act of 1917 and then the Sedition Act of 1918. And those two laws in effect, again, made it a crime for any person to criticize the war, the draft, the president, the Congress, the government, the flag, the Constitution, the military, or the uniform of the military of the United States. And unlike the Sedition Act of 1798, where the typical prison term for those who were convicted was 3 to 6 months, during World War I, individuals convicted under the World War I legislation were typically sentenced to prison terms of 10 to 20 years in jail. So it was an extraordinarily repressive regime. More than 2,000 individuals were prosecuted by the Wilson administration. And the practical effect of the large number of prosecutions and the draconian penalties was essentially to make any criticism of the war impossible. And so it was the most effective period in American history. It's simply silencing criticism of American policy.
I made the point earlier that, as you point out in your book, regret often follows episodes like this. Perhaps the clearest example of that comes after World War II, after the Japanese-Americans, two-thirds of those relocated are American citizens, are come to seen as people who suffered unduly. One Supreme Court justice calls it legalized racism to relocate them. What's remarkable is how quickly the regret sets in. But I guess the other point to observe is how many people, including justices of the United States Supreme Court, were swayed by the feelings of wartime. They're not immune to the perilous times themselves.
Not at all. I mean, part of what happens in a wartime environment is that there is a frenzy of patriotism, of rallying around the flag that develops within the nation. And there's a sense that the only way to do the right thing is to be supportive of the actions of one's government. And this affects not only citizens generally, but it certainly affects most judges and most justices. And one of the truly dark days in the history of the United States Supreme Court was when it upheld the Japanese internment in the Korematsu decision, holding in effect that the decision to intern more than 110,000 people of Japanese descent, two-thirds of whom were American citizens, was not based upon racism, but was based upon military necessity, when in fact there was no credible evidence presented that military necessity in fact justified the decision. And most of the justices who participated in that decision later did express regret. Making it even worse, it later turned out that the United States government, and the military in particular, had actually deceived the court by suppressing certain information that would have made clear that racism played a very large role in the decision, instead creating the impression that national security and military necessity were the primary factors. But this pattern of justices not having the clarity of vision or the backbone, frankly, to do what they know is right is a real challenge to the federal courts. One reason why this happens, apart from the overall mentality of wartime, is that justices, frankly, are being told in these sorts of cases by the executive branch, we know what is necessary to protect the nation. You may be very good at handling car accidents or interpreting the Constitution in times of peace, but the stakes here are so much higher than anything that you have ever dealt with. And these are not reversible mistakes. If you say that we cannot, in fact, intern the Japanese Americans, and they then go out and they engage in serious espionage and sabotage, that will have devastating consequences for the country. And so by blowing up the national security side of the case, the executive branch has traditionally, not invariably, but traditionally succeeded in getting the justices to back down, essentially saying, look, we better give deference here to the executive because they know a lot more about this than we do. And if we make a mistake here, the consequences for the nation can be very great. I do think the court itself has, over time, come increasingly to learn the lesson of the institution's own mistakes. And in June 2004, when we saw the Supreme Court reject the Bush administration positions on several important cases involving the war on terrorism, I believe what we saw was a court that was determined not to repeat the mistakes of the Japanese internment court, of the court that approved the Wilson prosecutions, and that approved many of the steps that were taken during the Cold War. A court that really said, we don't want to be remembered 30 years from now as the ones who made the same types of mistakes as some of our predecessors.
It seems like we've made progress in other areas, too. One thinks back to the days of Vietnam, to the criticism of the Iraq War now, and there are people saying all sorts of things critical of the war, critical of the officials who prosecute the war. And those critics are themselves not being hauled into jail, as Eugene Debs was, for example, during World War I.
Right. The Vietnam War marked a very important turning point in the United States' commitment to and understanding, and by this I mean citizens' understanding, of the nature of free speech. Until the Vietnam War, in every major conflict in American history, leading public figures were prosecuted, convicted, and jailed because of their public opposition to the war. Eugene Debs in World War I, as you mentioned, is a great example. Debs was the national leader of the Socialist Party. In 1912, he received 6% of all the votes cast for President of the United States, more than a million votes. And nonetheless, in 1917, after he made a speech criticizing the draft, he was prosecuted under the Espionage Act of 1917 and sentenced to 10 years in prison. While in prison, by the way, on that charge in 1920, he again received a million votes as a candidate for president. But by 1968, the nation seems to have come to understand the impropriety of that type of action. And so what people like Eugene McCarthy said about the Vietnam War, or what, to be more up to date, what Howard Dean said in 2004 about the war in Iraq, was every bit as critical and every bit as problematic from the standpoint of the administration as anything that Eugene Debs had said during World War I, or a former congressman named Clement Vallandigham had said during the Civil War, or a congressman named Matthew Lyon had said in 1798. Yet those earlier figures were all charged, convicted, and jailed for their criticisms. Yet in 1968 and 2004, it would have been unthinkable to the American people for Lyndon Johnson or Richard Nixon, or in 2004, George Bush, to have initiated a prosecution of their critics simply because of their dissent to the war. So that marks a very critical turning point in American history.
Well, Professor Stone, thanks so much for visiting with us.
My pleasure.
I've been speaking with Jeffrey Stone, the author of Perilous Times, Free Speech in Wartime, from the Sedition Act of 1798 to the War on Terrorism.
Peace activism is one form of free speech, and our guest commentator this week addresses such anti-war activity from the perspective of its impact. Has it ever really made a difference? Lawrence Whitner is a professor of history at the State University of New York at Albany.
Has peace activism ever stopped U.S. wars? It certainly stopped the Mexican War of the 1840s. Viewed as a war of aggression and as a war for slavery, the Mexican War stirred up strong opposition in this country. Thus, although U.S. arms triumphed on the battlefield, when the U.S. diplomatic negotiator disobeyed President Polk's call for a treaty annexing all of Mexico, Polk felt trapped. In the face of fierce public resistance to the conflict, the president reluctantly scrapped his annexation plan, and the war came to an end. Widespread peace activism also ended the Vietnam War. By late 1967, as Lyndon Johnson recalled, the pressure got so great that he feared Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara might have a nervous breakdown. Johnson himself was obsessed with the opposition his war policies had generated. After McNamara resigned and Johnson was driven from office by revolt within his own party, it was the Nixon administration's turn to give way to public pressure. The war and the peace protests, Henry Kissinger concluded, shattered the self-confidence of the U.S. foreign policy establishment. Furthermore, peace activism played a key role in ending the Cold War. The peace movement's struggle against the nuclear arms race and its clearest manifestation, nuclear testing, led directly to President Kennedy's 1963 American University Address and to the Partial Test Ban Treaty of that year, which began Soviet-American détente. Kennedy's speech was partially written by Norman Cousins, founder and co-chair of the National Committee for Sane Nuclear Policy, America's largest peace group. Cousins also brokered the treaty. When the Reagan administration revived the Cold War and escalated the nuclear arms race, these actions triggered the greatest outburst of peace movement activism in world history. Reagan was stunned. In early 1982, he started declaring publicly that a nuclear war could never be won and must never be fought. He added, "To those who protest against nuclear war, I can only say, I'm with you." In October 1983, he told his Secretary of State, "If things get hotter and hotter and arms control remains an issue, maybe I should go see Soviet Premier Andropov and propose eliminating all nuclear weapons." Consequently, in January 1984, Reagan publicly called for peace with the Soviet Union and for a nuclear-free world. Reagan acquired a negotiating partner in 1985 when Mikhail Gorbachev became Soviet Party Secretary. Gorbachev consciously modeled his new thinking on the peace movement's program and on the popular demand for peace. Working together, the two government leaders moved rapidly toward nuclear disarmament treaties and an end to the Cold War. When peace activism has reflected public opinion, it has stopped U.S. wars.
You've been listening to Lawrence Wittner, professor of history at the State University of New York at Albany. Wittner is also a former president of the Council on Peace Research and History, now the Peace History Society, and the author of several books and articles on peace movements, including The Struggle Against the Bomb, published by Stanford University Press. This is Talking History. To conclude this week's program that is focused on freedom in America, Talking History's Fiona Beattie tells us about a museum devoted to the subject.
The First Amendment of the United States Constitution affords Americans five fundamental freedoms. However, a recent survey found that only 28% of Americans were able to name more than one of those freedoms, and only 1% could name all five. On the other hand, the survey conducted by the McCormick Tribune Freedom Museum found that almost 52% could name two characters from the Simpsons Family TV cartoon. Perhaps this imbalance between the worlds of the Simpsons and the Constitution is best remedied by a visit to the McCormick Tribune Freedom Museum in Chicago, either in person or virtually. The museum, located on Michigan Avenue, opened on April 11, 2006 as, quote, "the first museum dedicated to helping people, especially teenagers, understand freedoms with a focus on those guaranteed by the First Amendment," end quote. Civics teachers will be delighted to direct their students to the website, where the five freedoms are discussed in depth. Cyber visitors have the opportunity for extensive independent exploration of the many themes of freedom, from a factual look at freedom around the world to the philosophical "what does freedom mean?" Click on each icon and read a short definition, and for those wanting more information, there's the option of exploring the topics further. For instance, "what does freedom mean?" is explored through three lenses: presidential voices, the people's voice, and quotes. And just for the record, can you name all of the five freedoms guaranteed by the First Amendment? If so, congratulations. I wonder if you can name two characters from The Simpsons. For more information on the First Amendment, that is, go to freedommuseum.us.
And that's it for another week of Talking History. We remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that Fiona Beattie is our producer, and Alex Smith our studio engineer, that the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the Talking History staff or of the OAH, and that to learn more about Talking History, all you need do is visit our website at oah.org. We welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to us at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or mail them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, thanks for listening. This is your host, Brian LeBeau.